Well, good morning, everyone. Good morning to Knoxville. Good morning to Harrogate. Everybody got their coffee? Are we good? Can we start? Okay, let's go. We have six lectures on GI together. It's my pleasure to be with you again. And I want to tell you that we're going to start out very basic and we're going to build through these six lectures. Let's look at the little cartoons here on the front. I like cartoons, and by the end of our six lectures, you'll be able to explain what each of these cartoon characters are doing in this sequence. And I have to admit, I'm fond of this one on the left because I have one granddaughter who's 8 years old, and I just love this four more dessert. I mean, let's just forget about new foods and veggies. Let's just make more room for chocolate. Okay, let's go ahead and get started here. What should you know from today's lecture? Well, we're going to go through the very basic regional anatomy of the GI tract. Then we're going to list the anatomical components of the regulatory systems, which are a very important part of what we're doing in GI. And number three, I'd put a little star beside number three. Differentiate between the intrinsic and the extrinsic regulation of GI. One, motility. Two, secretions. Okay? And then in terms of regulation, we're going to look at distinguishing the actions of hormones, paracrines, and neurocrines. Okay, so that's what we're doing today. Fairly straightforward. And here I've listed what you should be looking at in terms of practice questions. I've gone through each of these questions and I've looked at the answers, and I like these. I think these will help you. And then as you move on to some more clinically advanced questions, then go over here. So keep these in mind. It's well worth your time to go through those. Okay, let's start out with just some basic GI facts, okay? 70 million people afflicted annually. That's a lot. You as physicians will be seeing some of these people. 50 million primary care visits per year. 15% or 10 million hospitalizations per year. 10 million hospitalizations. These are going to be your patients. 200,000 deaths. That's frightening. Neoplasms, GI neoplasms. 100 million cases of diarrhea, and boy, I've had my share of that. 30 to 50 million cases of lactose intolerance, okay? And we're going to see why that's terribly important, because I'm going to jump the gun right here and say everyone in here should be lactose intolerant by now. Why aren't we? Okay. 10 million cases of hemorrhoid. Yeah, I've had my share of those too. 4.5 million cases of constipation. We're all guilty. 3 to 7% of GERD. And GERD starts to be a real problem. You guys are still in that wonderful time of life where you can get away with everything. When you start hitting your 40s, then GERD's gonna, all those things you like that are acidic are gonna start giving you grief. 3.5 million visits for irritable colon disease. And I'm going to put a fair bit of emphasis on that in our lectures as we go through the next few days together. Now, look at all of these symptoms. Is there anything that you could think of that doesn't have one of these symptoms? I mean, look at this. Just about any disorder that you can think of at this point would probably grab one or two or maybe even three of these. I mean, when you look at GI problems, do you really think of this one, skin problems such as rashes, eczema, and psoriasis? Do you think of pins and needles? Do you think of brittle nails? I mean, all of these here tell you just how important the GI tract is in regulating homeostatic regulation and maintaining basic physiology. Look at how many things can go wrong with the GI system. So what is the GI system? Here's the simplest way in the world to think of it. It's a tube that runs through your body. So it's just a tube from your mouth to your anus, and it has turns in it, it has valves in it, it does different things, but that's all it is, it's a tube. Do you guys remember E.T.? Am I having to find somebody new? Do you guys know? Okay, two E.T. fingers, one in the mouth, one you know where. And if you can wiggle them enough, they're going to touch each other. That's it. The GI system is nothing more than a tube running through your body with specialized regional functions. Okay, what's the objective of the GI system? Your digestive system is to break down food into fragments that are small enough to cross the lining of the GI tract. Okay? This is so we can get it across the wall from the lumen, from that tube, into the bloodstream. Now, look at the little picture here. You see all sorts of advertising. You're just bombarded with marketing that says, wouldn't you feel better if you had some of this in your body? And you say, yeah. Well, the problem becomes, look at the sign. You can't get there from here. By understanding what is an absorbable monomer, what can cross the GI system, what can get from the lumen of your stomach into your bloodstream to help you, you know, a lot of these things, yeah, I'd like to have some more of this in my bloodstream, but you can't get there from there. That's why you need to know what the GI system can break down and what can be absorbed. So that's an important thing to remember, because there's a lot of things being sold out there that just can't get there from here. So keep that in mind as you look at all the things and say, yeah, I'd like to have a little bit of this in my body, but you know, maybe you can, maybe you not can't. So think of that. What are these small pieces? These are called absorbable monomers. If you take in fats, then you're going to break it down all the way down to fatty acids and glycerol. Bigger things? Nope, they get broken down. Proteins get broken down into their monomers. Amino acids. Amino acids are what we transport across the GI wall into the bloodstream. Carbohydrates, we break them down to monosaccharides. These are the absorbable monomers, not the things on the label, not the things being marketed. This is what your body can do, and therefore what your body cannot do. So functions, very straightforward. I mean, we do this every day, ingestion of food. I have to confess, some of us do a little more of that ingestion than others, but ingestion, and once it's in, then we're going to look at propulsion. How are we going to move it from one specialized region to another? Part of the digestive process is mechanical, and that's where your teeth start, and you look at your teeth. Dentition. Dentition tells you what an organism eats. Are you just going to be like a cow and chew things? Or are you going to have just the incisors to tear? Or do you have everything that makes you an omnivore, which we are? We can eat just about anything, and I've tried. Okay, so we go through mechanical digestion, chemical digestion, and then we get down to absorbable monomers, and we're finally looking at absorption. This is what we're trying to take into our bloodstream, into our lymphatic system. This is what's going to be used by our body as a source of energy, as a source of ATP, and as the building blocks. And then we get rid of what we don't need, and that's the defecation process. So these are the six things that you always got to keep in mind. What are we taking in? Why are we taking it in? What are we going to do with it? How are we going to do with it? And what are we doing with the leftovers? Okay? So, digestive structures, this is the anatomical list. Yes, you should know every item on this page. You should be able to recite this. The mouth leads, which has salivary glands, should lead into the pharynx, which leads into the esophagus, which leads into the stomach. Now, here I've listed the three parts. You start where the esophagus comes in. You have the fundus, you have the body, you have the antrum. It's all part of the stomach, but those three things have very specialized functions. Know the difference between the fundus, the body, and the antrum. And then we have what's called accessory secretory organs, and this includes the pancreas. What does the pancreas do? Liver. What does the liver do? Gallbladder. What does the gallbladder do? Then we move into the small intestines. And here it's important to know the regional differences again. The duodenum, the jejunum, and the ileum. They're very different in terms of absorption and in terms of digestion. Certain regions are specialized for different functions. As we go from the ileum of the small intestine, we go into the cecum. So here's one of those valves. We have an ileocecal valve, which will now divide the small from the large intestine. And sitting right there at the cecum is the appendix. And indeed, what does or what did the appendix used to do? Then we move into the large intestine. So let's go in to start up with the ascending, then to go across the transverse. Now keep the transverse in mind because regulation of that transverse is going to split halfway. So the first part is regulated in one manner, the second part in another. Then we go to the descending portion. Then we go to that nice S-shaped sigmoid. That's why it's called sigmoid. And then we're going to go off to the rectum and then final through the anus for defecation. So rectum, anal sphincter, and thank goodness we have dual regulation of that anal sphincter. Okay, so if we take a look at the typical cross-sectional structure of the wall of anywhere in the GI, anywhere. So we're going to take a look, and what you're going to see, first of all, is there are two layers of muscle being characterized. There is circular muscle, and when you contract circular muscle, then that will narrow the diameter of that region of the digestive tract. Then we have longitudinal muscle, and the longitudinal muscle, when it contracts, will shorten, so we can get things narrower, we can lengthen, we can shorten, narrow fat. So there's all sorts of tricks we can do, and that's very important, we'll find next day, for motility. And then we're going to find out that there is a third layer of muscle in the stomach. Why? Why does the stomach, the only part of the GI system, have a third layer? What's going to be special about it? Why do we have that? And then there is two things we're going to talk a lot about today, and one of them is the myenteric plexus. Plexus, immediately you should be thinking regulation, okay? And then we have the submucosal plexus also, again, regulation. Why do we have two regulatory systems in the wall of the GI tract? Well, we'll find out today. So here's the stomach. And what I want you to notice here is that there is a third layer. So we have circular, we have longitudinal, but we have also in here oblique. Why do we have that third layer? That tells you that there is something very muscularly demanding about that stomach. And what we're going to find is if you look at the wall, okay, so we're going to start up here at the fundus. This is the esophagus coming in, then the body, and then the antrum. Now, the important thing to remember is as you move from the fundus to the body to the antrum, the thickness of the wall increases. So if you have a very thick muscular wall in the region of the antrum, that means you're going to have a lot of mechanical things going on, that you're going to have a lot of muscle contraction going on in the antrum of the stomach. Why is it going on in the antrum and not so much in the fundus and the body? Once again, regional specialization within the stomach. So when we look at the regulation, the autonomic nervous system, and now we're going to look at the control of motility, and what we're going to see is that there is an intrinsic nervous system within the wall of the GI, and it's called the enteric or intrinsic, and it's made up of two things. It's made up of the myenteric plexus, and it's made up of the submucosal plexus. Why two? Well, the myenteric plexus, let's drop down here, let's follow that nerve on down, is longitudinal and circular smooth muscle. So you remember we talked about lengthening, shortening, width, narrow, wide. This is all involved in motility. So the myenteric plexus is regulating motility. Now, the myenteric plexus also talks to the submucosal plexus. What does the submucosal plexus do? It's involved here, as you can see coming down, it is involved in regulating secretions. It is involved in secretions. And I like to think of the myenteric as being distinct from the submucosal, which I think of as being SNS, secretions and sensory. Secretions and sensory. And you can see here that it's the myenteric through interneurons which is allowing conversations to go on with the submucosal, and the blue here is showing the sensory going off back up to the ANS and the CNS. So we have two regulatory systems, the myenteric and the submucosal. Let's regulate the muscle activity and let's regulate sensory and secretory activities. So let's put that in a bigger perspective. So let's go over here to the right to something you've all seen many times. The brain and the spinal cord has an efferent division, which is voluntary and involuntary. So we're on to the autonomics. And that has the sympathetic and parasympathetic. And that now goes on to the enteric. So we have indeed the extrinsic, which is the sympathetic and parasympathetic, and the intrinsic, also known as the enteric, which is now within the wall of the GI tract. All through the GI tract, it's in the wall. Now, you've learned about sympathetic and parasympathetic when you talked about the heart, and you found that the heart, indeed, all the nerves to the heart could be cut, and because of the sinoatrial node, it can pace itself. The sinoatrial node can be influenced by the sympathetic system, which would give you a positive chronotropic and a positive inotropic influence, and the parasympathetic, which can slow down, so have a negative chronotropic, not so much on the negative inotropic. It's all chronotropic there. It's the opposite. Let me say it again. It is the opposite influence now on the GI tract. The sympathetic system, which still uses norepinephrine, will decrease digestive, okay? You remember it speeded up the heart. We're going to decrease digestive, the opposite. The parasympathetic is now going to increase digestive processes. So the extrinsic nervous system is going to have the opposite influence, but both a sympathetic and parasympathetic division. So now that's going to influence what's going on within the intrinsic or the enteric nervous system. And we call it now the myenteric, and it used to be called the Auerbach. And this goes back to the days when the guy who discovered something gets to name it. So we have Leopold Auerbach in the late 1800s, a German anatomist, and he made this discovery, so it's called the Auerbach. We're now changing our terms to being more descriptive, to being more technically correct. So historically, we still credited him, but we're going to use the term myenteric. And myenteric is this plexus we just talked about, which is going to regulate circular muscle for a process called segmentation, and it's going to regulate longitudinal muscle for a process called peristalsis. Then we have the submucosal, named after Georg Meissner, and Georg was also a German anatomist physiologist, also from the late 1800s, made the discovery, so he gets to put his name on it, now called submucosal, and this is SNS, secretions and sensory. So we do have an influence, just like we had on the heart, of the parasympathetic and sympathetic systems, but it's the opposite influence. Okay, you guys should all know this. You've seen this before. Let's review the basic floor plan here. In terms of sympathetic and parasympathetic, we have a dual neuron chain of command, the going from the CNS to the target tissue. In the sympathetic system, we have a short preganglionic, a long postganglionic fiber. Opposite in the parasympathetic, we have a long preganglionic a short postganglionic. Now, in terms of regulation, notice here that 1, 2, 3 are all cholinergic. The only thing is there's one exception. Postganglionic sympathetic fibers are adrenergic. Everything else is cholinergic, but there's a nuance. Preganglionic fibers are indeed nicotinic, whereas postganglionic are muscarinic. And notice that the postganglionic parasympathetic fibers are very short, which means that this ganglion is very close to the target, or it may be even in the target. So that's the main difference. Just remember, cholinergic, 3 out of 4. Nice way to remember. Okay, so we have dual regulation in the GI system. Okay, at home you may have air conditioning and heating. Okay, too hot, too cold. You got dual regulation. So here we go. Parasympathetic stimulates the activity of the digestive organs, stimulates the activity of the pancreas, stimulates the activity of the gallbladder. Okay, so on the other side, let's look at the air conditioning. Sympathetic inhibits the activity of the digestive organs, inhibits the activity of the pancreas, inhibits the gallbladder. Dual regulation, sympathetic, parasympathetic. Dual regulation means finer control. Okay, dual regulation means finer control. So if we have a better, closer look at this, we look at the parasympathetic. And the upper part of the GI system is regulated by the vagus nerve, which finds its root is in the medulla oblongata, cranial nerve number 10. 75% is afferent. Keep that in mind, because if we jump over the sympathetic, you find it's 50-50. Here, we have 75% afferent, 25% efferent. Now, what does the vagus nerve innervate in the GI tract? The upper third of the esophagus, the stomach wall, the small intestines, the ascending colon, and remember I said to pay attention? It now innervates the first half of the transverse colon. The second half of the transverse colon is now innervated by the pelvic nerve, and that means everything beyond that, the descending colon, sigmoid colon, is also innervated by the parasympathetic pelvic nerve. So we have vagal nerve, pelvic nerve, okay? And the transition is in the transverse colon. Let's look at the sympathetic. Sympathetic now, there are 4 sympathetic ganglia that serve the GI tract, the celiac, superior mesenteric, inferior mesenteric, and hypogastric. And these indeed will now give rise to postganglionic fibers to innervate, remember the enteric nervous system, myenteric, motility, and submucosal SNS, sensory and secretion. So we have dual regulation going on here. So the enteric nervous system is one of the divisions we've just seen of the autonomic nervous system. The other is extrinsic, intrinsic, extrinsic, balanced terms. One's inside, one's outside. So now, like the heart, the enteric nervous system is fully capable of regulating all GI activity. It can regulate all contractility. It can now regulate all needed secretory activity and all GI functions. So we really now can think of the body as having 2 brains. We have the brain in the head that does most things, but now we have a GI brain called the intrinsic or enteric nervous system, which is capable of fully regulating digestive processes, but can still be influenced, just as the heart was, by sympathetic and parasympathetic inputs. So here, let's take a look at a piece of the wall. This is the lumen, this is where the food is, and here we see in the wall the myenteric plexus, which is right through here, this dark streak, which is rhythmic contractions, longitudinal and circular muscles. This is motility. Then we drop down a couple layers down into the submucosal plexus, and the submucosal plexus is the SNS, secretory, and sensory, okay? So we have indeed in the digestive brain We have two parts to it. One, the myenteric regulating motility, the other regulating secretions. Okay, so the ENS is the only thing we find in the peripheral nervous system which indeed is fully capable of local autonomous function. So what is it that the enteric nervous system is doing for us? Contains complete, I would underline that word complete because it tells you it doesn't need further input, although there is some. Contains complete reflex circuits to detect the physiological condition of the GI tract. Okay, it integrates information about where we are, what we're doing. Okay, and it provides outputs to say, okay, if this is what we're doing, this is what we do next. Okay. So it is fully autonomous. So if we take a look at a neuronal circuit diagram, what we can see here, I'm not saying anything new in this. You know that it's my habit to sometimes say things two or three times because one might make better sense to you than the other. So let's take a look at it from another set of eyes. And here we have the longitudinal muscle, and here's the circular muscle. So right now you should be saying, oh, that's regulated by the myenteric plexus. Okay. And then we go on down here and we have the mucosal epithelium, and you're saying, okay, now this should be the submucosal plexus regulating it. And look at here, we've added in now parasympathetic, and we've added in some other inputs that we're going to build on the next slide. And you're going to see that these guys come in, and by and large, will be coming into the myenteric plexus. There's not an equal split. There's not an equal split of the parasympathetic input and sympathetic input to both layers. So it's not saying you layer A, myenteric, layer 2, submucosal, you're not going to get equal input. We're going to have a different hierarchy. Let's take a look at this. Okay, so we have the myenteric called the Auerbach, which is gut motility. We have the submucosal, which is digestive glands and sensory. And who are our players here? Well, if we take a look at communication that goes on in the myenteric plexus, we have acetylcholine, and we already know that, postganglionic cholinergic muscarinic receptors. And then we also have substance P, and these are both involved in muscle contraction. The inhibitory motor neurons are vasoactive intestinal peptide and nitric oxide. We're learning an awful lot more about nitric oxide as we study physiology. And these are involved in muscle relaxation, muscle contraction, muscle relaxation. Okay, now let's build a little further. So just to remind you, we have the myenteric plexus seen here in two views. Okay, here we're peeling away the layers, and here we have a cross section. So you can see the myenteric plexus here and here, and the submucosal here and here. And we have the extrinsic nervous system, which is now under the influence of the sympathetic and parasympathetic, which is now talking to the intrinsic. So we're going to have some input. Okay, so let's take a look at this. Myenteric Auerbach plexus. One, we know this. It's located within the muscle layers. Two, we know this. It regulates motility. And number three, provides innervation to all muscular layers of the gut, and it receives, this is important, that the myenteric receives both sympathetic and parasympathetic input. Now, why is that important? Let's jump over to the submucosal. Okay, this is in the submucosal layer, regulates the digestive glands, and the submucosal plexus receives only parasympathetic fibers. Only parasympathetic fibers. Let's see if we can make some sense out of that in another image. I like this. Here's the vagus nerve coming in, and the vagus nerve has indeed preganglionic fibers, and the postganglionic fibers are in the wall. And then we have indeed here the sympathetic system coming in, and now we have postganglionic. Here's the ganglion here, and we have a very long postganglionic fiber feeding in. So what we're finding here is the activity of sympathetic and parasympathetic on the two layers of the intrinsic nervous system are quite different. Okay, so the parasympathetic system, once again, increases digestive activity. It's now coming along the vagus nerve. And then that's for the first half. Remember the transition in the transverse? Okay, then the second half will be the pelvic nerves doing the same sort of thing. Now, this is an important thing to remember now in blue about sympathetic. It has an inhibitory effect. And the inhibitory effect in digestion of the sympathetic system is indirect through vasoconstriction. So it's not going to be acting directly on the submucosal plexus, but it's actually going to be regulating through blood supply to the submucosal plexus. Okay, so that's a very distinct nuance. And I like this figure, which indeed comes from your textbook. So here's the myenteric plexus. We have both sympathetic and parasympathetic input, but notice that they are both going to the myenteric plexus. And it's the myenteric plexus which then relays to the submucosal plexus. Here's the submucosal, and all input is coming via the myenteric. So it's the mediator. You want to talk to the submucosal plexus, you come through me. You come through the myenteric plexus, and I'll relay what I think is important. And the inhibitory effects of the sympathetic system in this manner will be on regulating blood flow. If you're going to inhibit something, let's have a little bit of vasoconstriction. Let's deliver less blood, less nutrients, less takeaway. So indeed, this is an important chart to remember, that indeed everything is mediated by the myenteric plexus, that indeed parasympathetic and sympathetic input both have to talk to the boss first. It has to talk to the myenteric plexus. Okay, so once again, same slide, you've seen this already because this is so important. Put a little star beside it. The generally inhibitory digestive effects of the sympathetic nervous system are caused by indirect vasoconstriction. Whatever you need to remember, highlight it, circle it, whatever you need, put a check mark beside it. Remember that hierarchy. So here it is in yet another perspective. And here we remember where we have the myenteric, where we have the submucosal, and now we have a wiring diagram. So here's the parasympathetic coming in, and that parasympathetic is coming in, and it's talking to the myenteric. No surprise, the myenteric's in charge. Then we have sympathetic. Sympathetic is coming in. Sympathetic, again, is talking to the myenteric, and then the myenteric relays things, and the negative effect of the sympathetic right here. Circle this on your slide. The myenteric works through inhibition by vasoconstriction. Okay, so the thing that's different here is the hierarchy of communication. And I've shown this to you now in three wiring diagrams. So if I've shown it three times, why not one more? So here it is. This should summarize it nicely for you, that we have distinct inputs where indeed the myenteric is in charge, and any input from the sympathetic or parasympathetic is mediated by the myenteric. I've said this several times now. Is that important? I think so. Okay, let's go on to regulatory substances. If we look at regulatory substances, we're going to look at peptides, and we can break peptides down into three categories. We can look at hormones, we can look at paracrines, and we can look at neurocrines. What do these peptide substances do in terms of regulation? Well, relaxation and contraction of the smooth muscle and the sphincters. The sphincters are gates from one region to another because we have regional specialization of function. Number two, secretion of digestive enzymes. Do we need more or do we need less? Secretion of electrolytes and water. Do we need more? Do we need less? And here's an important one people often forget. Trophic influences. Trophic influences. The GI tract has a really hard life. I mean, we have a lot of things being replaced because the environment is so harsh. So we have to have trophic influences. We need to say, okay, you guys, you need to start replacing yourself. You need to start, now that you've replaced yourself, you need to start specialization. So we have trophic influences for replacement, for growth, and we indeed have replacements here for specialized function. Okay, so you know we go through phases of life where indeed we may eat just a tiny bit more than we would a little time before, and we may need to now bump up the system to help deal with that. So peptides, relaxation, control of muscles, control of enzymes, control of electrolyte and water balance, and don't forget trophic influences. Let's first look at the hormones. Okay. Hormones, the most important thing to remember about a hormone is that by definition, all hormones must be blood-borne. They must be released into the circulatory system, and this gives you access to the entire body as a target. So the targets for a hormone can be within the GI tract, or it can be outside the GI tract. Well, let's take a look. If we produce a hormone called gastrin, gastrin is going to act within the GI tract, and it's going to act on the stomach parietal cells, and gastrin tells the stomach parietal cells, we need more acid. We just brought in some food. We need to do some acid digestion. Now, the target cells, on the other hand, for a hormone, could be outside of the GI tract. And this is GIP. GIP is glucose-dependent insulinotropic peptide. And this indeed will act on the pancreatic beta cells. You know what those do. Yeah, pancreatic beta cells, it's going to stimulate insulin release. Okay, so GI endocrine cells are not like ordinary endocrine glands that are all big clusters, and this is the gland. They could be loose. They could be a few here, a few there. They could be rather sparse, or they could be in small groups. So in terms of the major hormones for GI regulation, we have four that we're going to mention. Gastrin, cholecystokinin, and boy, cholecystokinin does so many things in the body. We're only going to talk about those things in the GI tract. We're not going to talk about all the other things CCK does. So when you do your reading, don't get confused because CCK does just so many things. And then we have glucose-dependent insulinotropic peptide, and we used to call this gastric inhibitory peptide. And then after a little bit more research, we said, you know, it does a little bit more than inhibition, so that inhibition is just a minor part of what it does. The major part is insulinotropic. So we kept three letters, GIP, but we now have a new name for it to reflect its major function. So what are paracrines? Paracrines are also hormones, and they're therefore secreted by endocrine cells, and they, by definition, since they're a hormone, they have to be blood-borne, and if they're blood-borne, it's going to, in this case, be acting locally. So rather than going into the entire circulatory system, we're just going to be passing through the extracellular fluid because it's acting locally. They're hormones released into the extracellular fluid to act locally. And one of the best paracrines, and in GI physiology, remember somatostatin. Somatostatin shuts everything down. You need to turn something off, use somatostatin. You're going to see this over and over again. Now, we'll also see histamine, and histamine is indeed a paracrine, but it's not a peptide. So put a little note here that this is an exception to the peptide rule. It is a paracrine, but it's not a peptide. And then we have that nice name, neurocrines. Now, neurocrines, what in the world's a neurocrine? Let's make it simple. It's a neurotransmitter, standard nerve neurotransmitter. Okay, and these include things like acetylcholine, norepinephrine, VIP, vasoactive intestinal peptide, includes enkephalins. Neuropeptide Y, much more important than you might think. You're going to see this one over and over again. And substance P. So we have three things going on: hormones, blood-borne, lots of exposure, and then we have paracrines. It's going to be blood-borne, but act locally through extracellular fluid, and neurocrines, which are simply going to be the release of neurotransmitters. So here are the hormones, and the blue are the rules. In order for something to be called a hormone, it's a very rigorous test. Okay, so it has to be, number one, secreted in response to a physiological signal. It has to be independent of neural signals. And then here's the hard part. If you want to say that gastrin, CCK, secretin, or GIP are hormones, you must be able to chemically isolate it. You must be able to chemically purify it. Then you must be able to sequence it, identify it, and then you must be able to synthesize it. That is very rigorous. And to this point, only these four have met all four rules, but we also have another category called putative hormones. Putative hormones, we're pretty sure they're hormones, but they just haven't met all four criteria. And here we have things like motilin, and we have ghrelin and leptin. We're going to be talking about these, and peptide YY. So there are putative, and those are there that have been definitely proven. The first one definitely proven is the hormone gastrin. And the hormone gastrin, this is nice, it's produced by G cells. Gastrin G cells, that works out well. And that's in the pyloric antrum of the stomach. And there is a little bit of this being produced in the duodenum and the pancreas. There are indeed, you remember that gastrin will stimulate the gastric parietal cells, and that will now release acid. So you got food in the stomach, we need acid. Okay, two types, little gastrin and big gastrin, okay? Little gastrin is released in response to a meal. You eat, you get 17 amino acid little gastrin. Big gastrin is what's released between meals. And this gastrin is responsible for distension of the stomach. Remember, there's rugae, there are folds, there are pleats that will allow expansion of the stomach. And then we have peptides and amino acids being present in the stomach, and those will be signals. And we have vagal stimulation. We're going to look at this a little bit more in the third lecture when we look at the regulation of acid production. And this acidic environment that we are going to create will feed back on the G cells, and it'll say at some point, you know, you guys are producing a lot of acid. I think we've got enough. The pH is good. And then somatostatin will come in and say, shut it down. Somatostatin, shut it down. Now, here's an important thing I want to jump into. When we take a look at the production of the hormone gastrin. There it is, we just did it. Now let's go forward. Gastrin can produce too much acid. Too much acid can produce ulcers. 4% of ulcers that are seen in the body are now due to tumors. They are due to gastrin-secreting tumors that are found in either the duodenum or the pancreas, okay? Now, of the gastrinomas, no matter what their sources are, 50% of those are malignant. Remember the cancer deaths. Remember the cancer deaths. And 25% are multiple endocrine neoplasia type 1, men 1s. We're going to talk about that later on in the GI section also. So we indeed have a very important hormone that can indeed have things that go wrong. So if you have a gastrinoma and you have too much gastrin, which means you have too much acid, simple enough to treat. We can use indeed proton blockers, and this can be in the pathway cimetidine, ranitidine. That's pretty much old school these days. There may be conflicts where you have to use those old school types, but everyone now uses a proton pump inhibitor, a PPI. And PPIs are things like omeprazole, and they're becoming so popular, you can now ignore your stomach saying, don't eat any more acid. This is no good for us. Okay, here's a PPI. Let's get another pizza. Okay, so surgical tumor removal is also an option if indeed the gastrinoma is too large, or indeed the receptors, you can resect the stomach, make the stomach a little smaller so you don't have as many parietal cells pumping out the acid. So there's Zollinger-Ellison syndrome, 4% of ulcers, but the important thing is that 50% of those can be malignant. Here's our buddy cholecystokinin. Cholecystokinin, there is so many things that this can do. Notice there's a cholecystokinin B and there's a cholecystokinin A. And indeed, these are indeed different in activity. So cholecystokinin B has some gastrin activity and we have lots of receptors for CCKA. They are made by the I cells. I wish they would be made by the C cells. It would make it so easy. But indeed, they're made by I cells, which are in the duodenum of the small intestinal wall. And CCK is stimulated by fatty acids. It's stimulated by monoglycerides. It's stimulated by amino acids and small peptides. So indeed, cholecystokinin, what is it going to do? Well, if you're indeed going to be dumping stuff from the stomach into the small intestines, the first thing you've got to do is get rid of some of that acidity because pancreatic enzymes need a neutral pH. So we're going to get gallbladder contraction, and gallbladder is storing bile, and part of bile is bicarbonate. Okay, we're going to get secretion of pancreatic enzymes. Okay, this is going to be for the digestion. We're going to secrete pancreatic bicarbonate. Also, so we're seeing bicarbonate from two different sources. And then we're going to have a trophic, remember the word trophic, influence on the pancreas and gallbladder, and we're going to inhibit gastric emptying. Okay, things like fats are very hard to digest. They need a little bit more time. So CCK is going to simply feed back and say, okay, I've got the bicarbonate coming in, but stomach, hold back. Give me a little more time. I need a little bit more time to finish digesting all of these fats and proteins and amino acids. So slow down, don't release anything more until I tell you. So that's an important part, inhibition of gastric emptying. Then we go into secretin. And secretin very nicely is secreted by S cells. And indeed, this will stimulate also the secretion of bicarbonate. And this is from the pancreas and the gallbladder, and this indeed is there. This is the main source of getting neutralization because our pH is going to be between 6 and 8 for pancreatic enzymes. And then we have the last one, glucose-dependent insulinotropic peptide. And this is being produced by the jejunum. Okay, so we have the duodenum, the jejunum, the ileum. So this is the middle section, K cells, which are going to be producing GIP, which will stimulate insulin secretion, and this will now help us deal with the sugars and blood glucose regulation. Okay, now we have putative hormones, and here I've listed them, and notice that they're not fully proven at this point. Things like motilin, pancreatic polypeptide, enteroglucagon and glucolike peptides. Oh, that's becoming popular. GLPs, my goodness. We're starting to see important things here. They are able to decrease blood sugar levels. Ah, so is indeed, I put a little asterisk here, would this be useful for the treatment of early type 2 diabetes? Okay, then we go to paracrines. And paracrines include things like somatostatin, D cells, delta cells, let's shut everything down. Histamine in here is another pathway for the stimulation of parietal cell production of acid. And then finally, we go to the neurocrines, simple neurotransmitters. These are produced by the nerve cells, and they are largely acetylcholine, norepinephrine. And then we have some neurocrines that are coming from peptidergic neurons, and this can include VIP, and look at the little footnote, I try to tell you what each of these do, enkephalins, neuropeptide Y, and substance P. So what we have seen today is an enteric nervous system. An enteric nervous system which can regulate motility, longitudinal and circular muscle, and submucosal plexus that indeed is involved in secretions and sensory. It has input from the autonomic system, from both sympathetic and parasympathetic. The most important thing to remember is that both of those inputs have to be mediated by the myenteric plexus, and the myenteric plexus then relays through interneurons onto the submucosal. And the other thing to remember is when we're going to do inhibition through sympathetic input to the enteric system, that it's going to be through vasoconstriction. And that's it. That's it. That's all we need to know for the first lecture. So we're done for today. Take care.
I thought Brandon's home.
It's